So, warm welcome, indeed warm. I hope it will be fine for this hour and a half here inside. So, it's a pleasure to have Carlo Notz here today, who will talk about a paper and the data set you will see. It is about the politics and sociology of getting tough on the unemployed. And this is a database about sanction and conditionality. He will talk more about this. But maybe before we start, some words about Carlo. So he is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Lausanne, at the Graduate School for Public Administration. And previously he has been a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Bremen, and he has been working on the drivers of public opinion. This is your new project, right? The drivers of public opinion towards immigrants and their access to social security systems. So that is what he is doing currently. And prior to the University of Bremen appointment, he has been in Lund doing his PhD with Johannes Lindwall. So he has published extensively on the topic he will talk about today, among other journals in comparative political studies, as well as the Journal of Social Policies and related outlets. So he is an expert in conditionality, sanctions, unemployment, etc. So it's really a great pleasure that we have Carlo here today. And then I'm also glad to welcome Raimund Heiler, who is from the Department of Sociology and who will act as a discussant today. With any further ado, I'd like to give the floor to Carlo. Thank you very much again. And we're looking forward to your talk.
Thanks from my side for the invitation and for the pleasure to be able to come here and talk about my work. As Flavia said, I've been doing mostly during my PhD and then afterwards as a postdoc in Bremen this work on the conditionality of unemployment benefits and the causes thereof and the effects of these policies. And that's essentially what I'm going to present. So the data that I collected together with Moran and Lund, and then the results that came out of this data collection. So this is the agenda. Basically, I want to say a few words about why I or we started this type of research, then introduce the data set and go over some findings, and then introduce some. So show you some open questions where, since the data are publicly available now, anyone can come in and hopefully clear up the things that I just cannot make sense of. Okay, so you probably all know these kind of headlines. So the middle one is from Austria. This is quite recent. I mean, there has been this recent debate about are there these Durchschummler, Schmarotzer, people who are lazy, claiming unemployment benefits without actually having the intention to look for work, and the proper response by the government. And you see, you can see this obviously in Germany. There has been a huge debate some 15 years ago. In the US, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives could not help himself but had to publicly announce that he doesn't like lazy unemployed people. In the UK, there have been for a long time these what they call crackdowns on the work shy, and you can trace this back basically already to the mid to late 1970s. The earliest sources I could find were in Australia. So this is a headline from the Sydney Morning Herald about public disapproval of lazy unemployed people. So this is basically what. This is basically the topic, right? So this debate about laziness among the unemployed and what the government should do to attack it, to deal with it. So, as you may also know, over the last sort of 30-something years, you see in basically all the advanced democracies, you see this trend towards turning the screws on the unemployed, getting tough on them. So in Germany, it was the Hartz reforms where they introduced a series of restrictions. They tightened the requirements that people had to fulfill to claim unemployment benefits. They introduced a tougher sanction regime. We know in the UK, under Thatcher, they introduced a series of reforms in Australia and New Zealand all the way through to 1970s, 80s, early 90s, and up to the mid-2000s. There was a series of reforms where one government after the other tried to outdo the government that came before and be tough on the unemployed. You see it also in the Nordic countries. In Denmark is one of the countries where they introduced over the 90s a series of unemployment benefit cutbacks, or they introduced tougher requirements. And so obviously that has not gone unnoticed by academic researchers. And so there's the first sort of major group of the major literature, the major line of scholarship, which is on the fact that welfare states change and the reasons why, right? So the political factors behind it. And so people have called this phenomenon, this the fact that countries introduce tougher policies for lazy unemployed people as the rise of the welfare state. It's somewhat dramatic. A bit more qualified is this headline of calling it the activation term, where you sort of try to activate the unemployed, get them back into work, and these what you would call demanding activation, fordern activation is one part of it, and then there's sort of more general literature that we call it retrenchment or maybe recommodification. So they've all taken notice of it and tried to find explanations for it. And then there's of course this a large amount of research in sociology and economics on the effects of these policies, right? So what economists, for instance, Raphael Lalive in Lausanne, have been concerned with is, if we introduce tougher sanctions for the unemployed and tougher job search requirements, does that actually work? Does that get people into work? Or, does it just make life more difficult for them without producing any good effects? And so basically there have been three main arguments. One that's from American political scientists, Lawrence Mead and Charles Murray. They've been huge fans of this. I mean, they've openly advocated for workfare. As in my reading, it has also some racial undertones in it, about the inner city and all the darkness and stuff. So they are big fans of it. Economists typically have been a bit more qualified about it. They said, we see in our experimental research imposing a sanction on someone who's been lazy or who has refused an offer of employment that can help speed up transitions into employment, but it also has costs, right? So people tend to end up in lower quality jobs, in less well-paid jobs, and these effects, these negative effects in pay and job quality, they are enduring. I mean, you see them years after. So, ups and downs, and then often from the side of sociologists, they've pointed out the often very harsh consequences of these policies. Right? So people, they cannot make their rent payments, so they end up homeless. There's this paper from the UK have shown that there's this association between the tougher sanction regimes and larger take up of food banks. These kind of policies can have very harsh effects on those people because, I mean, the people we're talking about, these are people that have nothing to begin with, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't claim unemployment benefits, so they wouldn't be eligible. So if you take something away from them, that can have harsh consequences. So far, so good. The main issue, or the main thing that always bugged me before starting my PhD was there was almost no data. Right? I mean, every time when I approach a book or a paper with the questions, or tell me in whatever, between 1990 and 2005, what exactly has happened in Germany, what kind of reforms have they introduced, what was the status in 1990 and how has it changed before, how does Austria compare, how does the UK compare, how does Sweden compare? Nobody could tell me. And the reason why was there was no data. Nobody had bothered to, have some inventory on, or assemble some inventory, some data on what these rules are, the sanction rules, the job search requirements, the definition of suitable work, all these kind of rules that define the conditionality of unemployment benefits. Nobody has bothered to write them down and collect them in some way. So, I mean, obviously there are data sets, comparative data sets on welfare state social policies, but they focused on entitlements. So what do you get, how much money do you get, and for how long, but nothing really on the obligations. And so those studies that have looked at either the causes or the consequences of these tougher conditionality policies, they've been single country studies or smaller comparisons. And then a few people, so there was the Danish Ministry of Finance, the Council of Europe, and then later the OECD that did this sort of expert survey studies where they sent out questionnaires to various countries and then ask them what are the rules, but they only give you cross-sections. So we have one cross-section in 1999, one in 2005, one in 2012, and obviously there are huge gaps in between. And so they give you some information, but they don't give you the whole picture. The issue is this leaves basically, from my perspective, three questions open. So one is this whole issue of, is there really a welfare state on the rise? I mean, how dramatic are these changes really? You know, are we talking about some really dramatic changes where basically it's impossible to claim unemployment benefits nowadays, or is it more cosmetic? How tough have countries actually gotten? And how do they vary? You know, is the UK really as tough as everyone thinks they are? Is Sweden as lenient as everyone thinks they are? Is that really true? I mean, we don't know. We didn't know because we didn't have any data. Then the question is, do these reforms actually work? Do they increase employment and reduce unemployment? And so obviously we have some insights from economic research, but what was lacking was the broad comparative perspective, right? So the question, do countries with stricter rules also have better labor market performances? There is actually, there was a hearing in the UK House of Commons around 2012 when they introduced a very significant restriction of their sanctioning regime. And it's quite interesting because they had some experts invited, and one committee member kept asking the experts, can you tell us, is there any kind of data that tells us when we introduce these tougher sanction rules, will that lead to reduced unemployment? Do you have any data? And she kept asking him, and he couldn't give us a clear answer. I mean, the answer is no, there wasn't data at the time. There was this only like the data from the OECD, but nothing really, no data source that would allow to really answer this question in a meaningful way. And then the third question is, why are countries doing this? Right? So what is behind these reforms? What are the politics of these reforms? There were some ideas, there are some hypotheses about this, but they haven't been seriously tested, and so, you know, for our purposes, we have theories but no evidence. So we don't know for sure. Now, so this is what I thought when I started my PhD. So, you know, we know what the problem is. We know that we need data, so someone just has to do it. And so luckily, I found a companion in Moira. So back in 2012, we thought, okay, you know, let's just get this over with. Let's just do it. Let's just collect these data. It will be 2 years of excruciatingly boring, annoying work, but you know, then we have the data, and hopefully we have some new findings. And so we got financial support from the Swedish foundation, luckily, that allowed us to do this data collection. And so here's basically what we did. Our project was called Quantifying Conditionality. So we picked 21 OECD countries, what you would usually refer to as the core OECD, which is Western Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, Korea, and Japan, so the major industrialized countries. We actually have 22 countries. The 22nd country are the US. The issue is that the US are so radically different from the rest of the country because everything is on the state level, which meant, you know, it was extremely difficult to collect data on 21 countries plus 50 states. And then the issue is also it's not really comparable, right? So you can't really compare Arkansas to Austria. These are different countries or different political entities. So for now, we left it at 21 OECD countries, and maybe if someone ever has too much time on their hands, they can code in the US. So basically, what we aimed for was start in 1980 and up to 2012, so the start of the activation term up to the present back then. And so what we wanted to collect was data on job search conditions. So basically, how often you have to report in at the unemployment office and show how many applications you've written or how many interviews you've attended, what you have done. Then what we call availability conditions, or what type of job do you have to be available for. It's also called the definition of suitable work. Or you can also formulate in the negative, what types of work can you refuse without losing your entitlement to unemployment benefits. So often, prostitution. In Germany, at least, it's a legal job. It's a legal occupation. And there was actually one case where a caseworker said, "Hey, they're looking for prostitutes, and why don't you apply there?" The woman sued, and like 5 minutes later, the court said, "That's not a suitable occupation. If you want to do it, sure, but you can't force them." There are different rules, right? So often countries define what you call in German Berufsschutz, so you cannot be forced to accept work in different occupations. You cannot be forced to commute very long distances, you can't be forced to accept very much lower wages, and so on and so on. So that's what we look for, and then different types of sanctions, so for when you become unemployed voluntarily, when you refuse an offer of suitable work, and when you fail to actively seek work when you're lazy. So this is what we did, basically. We went to the statutes, to the one in Austria with BD, what is called the Bürgerlichesgesetze, also in German, where the laws are, and looked for the last major revision of the unemployment benefit code up prior to 1980. So often in Austria it was 1977, in Germany it was 1969, in our Italian collaborators, they went back to 1924. In Greece, we have data from 1950 onwards. It's a bit variable, depends a bit on what we could find, but generally we have it from 1980 onwards, at least. Except for countries like Switzerland, where the unemployment benefit was introduced later, so it was introduced in 1982, if I remember correctly. So then we went over this and looked for the relevant paragraphs or sections. And then once we had that, we tracked their development over time. So we basically flipped through the law books and saw, okay, so there was this reform in 19, the law was introduced in 1977, the first reform was in 1981, then there was one in 1985, then there was one in 1995, then there was one in 2004, and so on and so on. Extremely time-consuming work. Then we wrote all the stuff up that we found in summaries, between 20 and 50 pages per country, sent that to expert reviewers, so the people who are experts in the respective countries. In Austria, it was people at the Arbeiterkammer who've looked over this and validated it. Then, once we had it validated surveys back, we coded the data, so we tried to assign numbers to the various, to the information that we find, so we could make it machine readable, and we did that for all 21 countries. We are collaborators. So just to give you an idea, you probably know how this looks like. So this is the 1977 Arbeitslosenversicherungsgesetz in Austria. Starts here, Article 1, and so here this is an example. This is the equivalent of job search requirements. So how often do you have to report at the employment office, and then I couldn't get this on the page, but here's already the sanction. So an Arbeitslosenversicherung and so on and so on. I think you would lose benefits for a week, if I remember correctly. So that's basically the data that we collected for all these countries. Then, since you have this huge, this kind of unwieldy assembly of different rules, and you ideally you want to break it down into one number, right? One single thing that you can actually analyze that gives you an overall picture. We followed the example of these earlier studies from the Danish Ministry of Finance and the OECD, and constructed these aggregate synthetic indicators. So basically what we did, once we had this numerical data, so once we had, say, numerical a number for the strictness of occupational protection rules, right? So can you be forced to accept work outside of your occupation? And all these different aspects, we aggregated them. So basically for the condition side, the side of behavioral requirements, what you have to do in order to keep unemployment benefits, we essentially assigned scores that scored the strictness of these rules. And then we summed them up, and that gives us an overall idea of how strict the reasons are. It's not no rocket science, really pretty basic. We did the same thing with sanctions, and then we created this indicator for the overall conditionality. And so conceptually we thought the conditions side and the sanctions side are kind of an interactive relationship. Right? So conditions only matter to the extent that if you don't comply with them, it hurts. Right? And the same thing with sanctions. Sanctions only matter if there is something that you can be sanctioned for. So very strict sanction rules. So, you know, the tiny slip up and you lose all your benefits. They don't really matter that much if the conditions are super lean. If you can do whatever you want, because then you will never ever get sanctioned. And likewise, if the sanctions are super lenient, then the conditions can be super strict. But who cares? The consequences are just not very severe. So you multiply the two to express that kind of interactive relationship. It's like in statistical analysis, right? So you multiply things when you have an interactive relationship. Also not rocket science. So I'm not going around saying that this is the be-all, end-all solution to measuring the conditionality. It was just a pragmatic solution to getting a measure. Okay, so here's what we found, or what I found mostly in my dissertation. First of all, the main question, you know, is there a rising welfare state? Are they abolishing our church welfare state? And are we completely subordinate and without any kind of rights when we're unemployed? Or is there something left that protects us? So what we found, again, going back to the example of occupational protection, can you be forced to accept work outside of your original or your main occupation? So you see that as of 1980, about half of the countries had what we call unlimited protection. So as long as you were claiming unemployment benefits, nobody could force you to accept work outside of your previous occupation. If you were a welder before, and there were 1,500 other jobs as a dock worker, you could refuse them and say, I'm a welder, I do not work as a dock worker. A bunch of countries had temporary protection, so in the UK they call it a permitted period. So they say, for the first X months, you can limit yourself, but if that doesn't work, you have to accept other work. And then there are countries like New Zealand, where there's no protection. So from day one, any job outside of, even if it's outside of your occupation, is fair game. And you see that the countries that, more and more countries have successively abolished this protection. So in more and more countries, it's either only temporary or you see a very clear increase in the countries that basically offer no protection. So you have to accept the work outside of the occupation. So this is one case where there have been restrictions. And then the second case where it's very drastic, that when it comes to the job search requirements. So, which is what I would call the essence of the activation term. Right? So what countries have done is to monitor what the unemployed do in a much more stringent and strict way. So the first thing you see is, as of 1980, about 70% of all countries had no requirement to really actively look for work. Right? I mean, this was really the time when this is the best indication of a passive unemployment benefit system. Right? You would just claim benefits and nobody would check what you do. Whether you look for a job or not, nobody cares. And that has changed radically. So now there are only 10% of the countries, I think Greece is one of them, where they don't have these rules. And it's very clear that you at least have to look you have to report at least every 6 months or in some undefined intervals. But there is, in basically almost all countries, there is some requirement that you have to report to the unemployment office and say, and show that you have been doing this. So I know that in Sweden, for instance, you have to submit a written activity report every week through an online portal. You have to write up, I've applied for these and these jobs, I'm still waiting for that, I've gone to so many interviews, you send it off. If you don't send it, you get automatically sanctioned. You automatically don't get your benefit for the company. So it's very strange. And then the second case is job seeker agreements, which you would also call the individual action plan, where you know, when people sign up for unemployment benefits, they have to sign an agreement, and, you know, where it says, I, the unemployed, will do X, Y, Z, and the employment agency will do 1, 2, 3 to help you doing this, and we sign it, and we both commit to doing this. And this is an instrument that's spread very, very rapidly across, it was, I think, pioneered in Massachusetts, and then went over Australia, New Zealand, the UK, all over the United States. So these are examples of restrictions. And then this is something that at least I really didn't expect. That is, in some cases, there's greater leniency. And this is what I would call the, with reference to Paul Pearson, an updating of availability criteria. So basically what you see here that is that countries have realized that they're, you know, that the labor market of the 2000s doesn't look the same way as the labor market of the 1960s. Right? In the 1960s, it was much more male-dominated. Right? There were much fewer women working. Also, in consequence, there were much fewer women who were unemployed. Right? If they wouldn't find a job, they would rely on their husband. Nowadays, you have women working and women being unemployed and women claiming unemployment benefits. And women, the fact that women are in the labor market and want to participate means that both women and men, moms and dads, right, that they are now in the situation where they have to reconcile their responsibilities to their kids with their working life. And that's what's slightly but increasingly reflected also in this availability criteria. And so in many countries it started at 20%, now it's at 40% at least, it might be even higher now. You can refuse an offer of employment if that would mean that you would have to leave back your kids or you neglect your caring responsibilities. That's a case of updating, right? So you update the rules to reflect the fact that nowadays you have working parents, many of them women. Also, caring responsibilities are these, that's actually much more. Almost all countries have this one. So, ethical concerns, so, you know, we live in much more diverse and multicultural societies. In the 1950s, you know, if there was a job at a slaughterhouse available, you could safely assume that most people would be Christians, and most people, they might mind killing an animal, but they might not mind killing a pig. Right? Nowadays, you can't assume it, right? I mean, there are, you know, you have Muslims, and you have also Hindus and other people who just, you know, they really don't want to deal with certain pieces of meat or certain types of meat. And so you can't force them to work in occupations where they might be forced to do this. Also, in Denmark, for instance, is an example where it was legitimate to refuse work if it involved the production of war material. And it's reflecting the fact that in war people are pacifists. And so the fact that these things are more commonly considered as legitimate reasons for refusing an offer of employment, I mean, so first of all, it's a sign of leniency, right? So before you had to accept it, now you can refuse it. And it's also against updating. So this is where the picture becomes a bit more qualified, as opposed to it's the rise of the world.
I just small point because when I read your paper, I never heard the word leniency before. So I just want to tell you nachlässigkeit, milde.
And then I mean another example is that, you know, skills, I mean, jobs have become more demanding, and it's more common that you have jobs that you're just not qualified for, right? So someone who's been working as a model for 30 years might not be qualified to work as a programmer for Apple. Yeah. And then you can refuse this if you're just obviously not qualified for the job. Okay, so here's the overall picture. So this is where we look at the, so previously we looked only at sort of several sub-aspects, tiny slices of the data. And now we look at these aggregate indicators. And so you see the strictness of conditions. So this measures, in essence, how actively and how widely do you have to look for work. A very low number means you basically don't have to do anything. And even if a job comes up, chances are you don't have to accept it. A high number means you have to look for work all the time in whatever job is available, it's probably going to be, you know, considered suitable. And so you see very clearly that there has been a very noticeable increase. The same with sanction rules. So as of 1980, these were more relaxed, and then over the 1990s, 80s, 90s, they increased relatively drastically. And you also see this since the solid line, that's just a product of these two. It just reflects the fact that in both cases, the rules have become stricter. Just to give you an idea of how that looks when you look at the individual countries, you see that some countries have always been kind of strict. That's Australia, that's the Netherlands, Belgium. Although you have to say that in these countries it's mostly because they always have very tough sanctions. So in the southern European countries, traditionally, it's also something I didn't know, basically any violation of the rules means you lose your unemployment benefit, period. You know, it's no temporary exclusion, you just lose your unemployment benefit. And so that's why these countries get very harsh scores. But you see, so the countries where we know that they have taken great or noticeable steps towards activating the unemployed, the Netherlands, you see an increase. So from they were in 1980, noticeable increase. Austria has done the same, it's a very strong increase. Germany, very strong increase. The UK, Finland, Denmark, Switzerland less so, Japan less so, but basically, apart from a few cases where you have minor, sort of on balance, minor reductions, the trend has been up. That's in most countries that become stricter. So, that's the first main finding. So yes, there is a very clear trend towards stricter rules, but there are important nuances and exceptions, and this is, if you ask me, sometimes that tends to be forgotten in some of the literature, you know, tends to prefer drama over nuances. So I don't think there's a workfare state. There's an increase in strictness, but not a workfare state. So the second finding, this is for some reason, well, not for some reason, this is the thing that everyone cares about, which was for me, since as a PhD student, I didn't work on that question, was always a bit frustrating, because that's what people kept asking me about, does it work? And I just didn't have a good answer. So in my postdoc, I finally managed to look at it, and now I finally have an answer to this question, and I also start always with it, because that's what people want to hear. So be it. Okay, so this is when you correlate this overall indicator, this is all encompassing aggregate indicator of the conditionality of benefits with the employment rate. So, I mean, according to this, what you would call maybe neoliberal logic, stricter countries should have higher employment rates or conversely lower unemployment rates. So you should see a very clear relationship that looks like this. And obviously that's not what you see. And so basically there is no relationship, or if there is a relationship, it's negative and it's very clearly not significant, right? It's just countries are all over the place, which, you know, is a bit puzzling, but then once we start to disaggregate things, we see why that is the case. That's the case because here we look at the two sub-indicators that make up this overall indicator. So you have the condition side, how actively and how widely do you have to look for work, and there you actually find a positive relationship. So yeah, there it turns out that countries who are forcing the unemployed to look more actively, more widely, they do tend to have higher employment rates, with some exceptions. Switzerland is just, you know, an exceptional case, just a very high employment rate, even though it's comparatively lenient. And then, interestingly, with sanction rules, it's the exact opposite. Right? So countries that have tougher sanction rules tend to have lower employment rates. And this is the clearest in all the southern European countries I just mentioned. That's Greece, Spain, Italy, Portugal, also France and Belgium. So all countries that are not known for being top performers when it comes to the labor market, they all have comparatively harsh sanctions. So in all the southern European countries, traditionally, one strike, you're out. Right? That's the rule. In Belgium, they have, I mean, they say, well, a sanction can range anywhere from, I think, 1 week to the entire year. technically it can be a very harsh sanction, and so obviously these kind of harsh rules do not seem to, you know, do not seem to result in any noticeable improvement in the labor market performance. So obviously these are just cross-sectional graphs, right? This is just cross-sectional, it's just a correlation. So the big issue is here we don't know which direction these relationships go into, right? And what I did to disentangle this a bit was to run a time series specification. So since I have data from the 1980s to today, I can look how things change over time, right? So if a reform at one point, so say Austria in 1990 introduced a reform that tightened these job search criteria, if then a few years later, or over a few years later, you see an increase in the employment rate, that gives you an idea of the direction of causality, right? On the other hand, if you don't see that, but you see that an increase in the employment rate or a decrease in the employment rate is followed by a reform, because you know, all of a sudden unemployment becomes a serious political issue and governments want to do something about it, then you see that relationship. So when you look at it over time, you can disentangle the error of causality. And so here I run a regression where the employment rate is the dependent variable and these indicators are the independent variable, and in a time series model you have to do some bit of extra work. You have to compute what's called a long run multiplier or a long run effect. And when you compute that long run effect, you see that stricter job search conditions, they do have a statistically significant positive effect on employment over subsequent years. Sanctions don't, and I mean this is when only this indicator is introduced, and this is when both are introduced as a robustness check, and you know the picture doesn't change, the results are robust. Which means as far as the effects are concerned, and as far as the effects on employment are concerned, forcing the unemployed to search more actively, more widely, does increase employment. But punishing those who don't comply more harshly does not seem to increase employment. Mm-hmm. So that's the main finding that I took out of this data. Now, this leads me to the next group of findings. What are the politics behind it? Why are countries doing it? And this is related because, again, recall that there was this negative association between the strictness of sanction rules and the employment rate. So countries with tougher sanction rules, like Greece, Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands also, have lower employment rates than countries like Denmark, Sweden, or Japan, Austria also, have lower employment rates than these countries. And so, since we didn't find an effect that goes from the rules to the employment rate, possibly the effect is the other way around, right? So possibly, you know, sanction rules are tough because the labor market doesn't work, because unemployment is high. There's this political logic included. And you see that in Indeed. So here are two cases where you see over time this pattern is very pronounced. So in New Zealand, or in Ireland, it's maybe even more clear. Unemployment increased here, decreased a bit, increased, was followed, and especially here, so this is the response to the Great Recession, right, the financial crisis of 2009 and the following years. Unemployment explodes, and what does the government? They follow immediately with the sanction reform. So they say, now we crack down on the lazy unemployed, and we toughen sanction rules. And you see that over time in New Zealand, there was an enduring increase in unemployment, and followed by a sanction reform. Unemployment decreased, sanctions were actually relaxed again up to the mid-2000s, and again, the financial crisis, unemployment increases, sanctions get tightened. And again, you can also show this in a regression model with all the countries included. You see a significant long-run effect of unemployment on the strictness of sanctions. So if there's an enduring increase in unemployment, sanctions tend to be tightened. And should also mention there's also an effect of budget deficits. So when the government runs out of money, they kind of look, I mean, they tend to look for a scapegoat. And so we don't have enough money, so what do? We cut, or we take money from the lazy unemployed. That's a way to get some extra revenue, or at least signal to voters that we're doing something about it. And again, interestingly, you don't see this effect when it comes to the conditions side. Right? So the side that was just shown has a positive effect on employment. There, this opposite, this political effect doesn't exist. So, as far as I know, as far as I've made sense of so far, increased unemployment leads to stricter sanction rules, whereas stricter benefit conditions reduce unemployment or increase employment. So this is the basic story. There's a bit more to it, but I have to speed up a bit. So the thing is then, there are lots of open questions. So I feel like even though I've been working on this for a couple of years, I mean, I've kind of explained this much of it. And most of it is still completely unclear. So one is, what is it then that drives these job search availability conditions reforms? Why are countries deciding to force the unemployed to look for work more actively, more widely? And I literally do not have a good answer to this. I can't figure it out. I've run tons of regressions. Beats me. I have no idea. So here are two ideas that I'm entertaining. So one is that it's because of policy convergence or diffusion mechanism. Right? So countries learn from one another. And the clearest example is this job seeker agreements. That's an instrument, again, originated in the US and then spread to first the other Anglo-Saxon countries, and then over time it spread over Europe, and then you see also in Asia, to basically all the advanced democracies. And because these instruments are so similar, you know, in the UK you call the Job Seekers Agreement, in New Zealand you call the Job Seekers Contract, in Sweden I think you call the Individual Action Plan, the same as in Germany, so that suggests that countries kind of copy these rules from, or these reforms from each other. So that could explain this kind of policy diffusion process. There's also a partisan effect. So I found that left governments, so social democratic or further left governments, are significant or clearly, I don't know if it's statistically significant, but clearly less likely to tighten these rules than non-left governments. Although they also do it on balance, they also do it, but significantly less. So that could also explain the benefit. But overall, I don't know. If anyone has a good idea, I'm happy to hear it. Another open question. You may notice, you know, in this welfare state research, everyone talks about regimes. There's always this expectation that there are these clusters of countries. There's the Scandinavian regime, there's the continental European regime, there's the liberal regime, or the variation that I look at is the varieties of welfare capitalism, right? So you have the liberal market economies, basically all the Anglo-Saxon countries, and coordinated market economies, all the continental European countries. And at least Margaret Davis Alva and Tom Iverson, David Soskis, they have made this argument very explicit. Coordinated market economies should have more lenient rules. It would also follow from the Espinandersen framework that countries in continental Europe and northern Europe are more lenient, but the most explicit argument, or the most explicit way this argument has been made is in the varieties of capitalism literature. So they said this is the case. They also say that they have some data that shows it. My data don't show it at all. Sanctions are somewhat more lenient, but this is mostly because of the southern European countries. Once you take them out, the difference is not really good anymore, and job search and availability conditions are slightly more lenient in coordinated countries, but nowhere close to what the norm suggests. So this is kind of an interesting puzzle, because these countries and these groups of countries differ on so many different things, but not on this indicator. So then the question is, why is that? When everyone and all the theories tell us they should differ, but they don't differ, and it's an interesting puzzle, I find. The final thing is trade unions. So there's this argument in the literature that stronger unions, they have a strong interest, or unions generally have a strong interest in generous unemployment benefits, right? Just for economic purposes. if unemployment benefits are generous, and if people, if unemployed workers can refuse a wide degree of available jobs, that limits competition in the market, it limits the supply of labor. And it strengthens trade unions. And so that's why they should have an interest in generous unemployment benefits to sort of to reduce the, I think what Marx called the reserve army of labor. That's what you want to reduce that pressure on the labor market. And some people have actually shown unemployment benefits tend to be more generous. But when I look at my data, I don't find any relationship whatsoever. Which is also, to me, it's at least an interesting puzzle. I have two possible explanations. So one is unions just are not strong enough anymore. Right? So basically this is all happening against unions, but they've become weak over time and they just can't defend themselves anymore. The other case is unions are mainly insider organizations, right? So especially in countries like Spain and Italy, they only defend mostly older employed people. They don't care what goes on with the unemployed. And so for them, unemployment benefits are not relevant anymore. Also a hypothesis. So, yeah, the open questions, lots of stuff is still unclear. If anyone wants to look at it, the data are available. You can download them, you can familiarize yourself with them, and hopefully come up with better answers than I managed and ashamed to admit 7 years of work. So that's it for me. Thank you, and look forward to your comments.